Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back. Tonight's episode is an essay, an article, if you will, or a deep dive piece of research written by one of our researchers, Grace. What started as data that we were researching for another episode soon snowballed into an op-ed that we thought held so much water that it should be run as its own episode. Grace has been researching this subject for the last month or so and has spoken to a number of our listeners and experts in the field to gain an understanding of how this subject is affecting people. So to be clear, I will be delivering tonight's episode in the first person, but all research and writing credit goes to Grace Thomas, whose voice this episode truly is. This is Dead Millennium. Like everyone else in my generation, I'm finding it increasingly difficult not to be scared about the future and angry about the past. I am a millennial, part of a generation born between 1981 to 1996. And for a decade now, like many of my generational buds, I've been waiting for adulthood to kick in. My monthly rent consumes nearly half of my income. Well-paid and constructive job roles are few and far between. The cost of food is at its highest it has been in my lifetime. Gas or petrol prices are at a 30-year high, and my savings are dwindling faster than the ice caps the baby boomers melted. Now sure, we all have read the statistics. More millennials live with their parents than alone or with roommates. Millennials are delaying marrying or coming into long-term relationships and house buying and even having children for longer than any previous generation did. It's always surprising to me when members of my parents' generation tell me that they were married and had children while they were still teenagers. The problem with millennials, at least according to older generations, Generation X and Baby Boomers, are all entirely our fault. Millennials studied the wrong degree. They spend money they don't have on things they don't need. They haven't learned or developed any useful skill sets. They caused the death of department stores and golf and napkins, humor, conventional families, religion, and lunchtime. They spend all of their time at Starbucks and eat way too much avocado on sourdough toast. Mention the word millennial to anyone over the age of 40 and the word entitlement will come back at you almost right away. Damn it, millennials destroyed the world. This is what it feels like to be young now. Not only are millennials screwed, but they have to listen to lectures about the laziness and their low effort participation trophies and all of this from people who screwed them over in the first place. These, of course, are generalizations, though they are all sourced from genuine articles, op-eds, and media pieces on the subject of millennials. But generalizations aside, many of the criticisms they endure from previous generations fall apart under the slightest scrutiny. And contrary to the cliche, the vast majority of millennials did not go to college or university. They do not work as baristas, and they cannot lean on their parents for financial help. Every stereotype of our generation applies only to the tiniest, richest, whitest sliver of young people. And the circumstances we live in are more complicated than what most people realize. Millennials have taken on at least 300% more student debt than our parents. We're about half as likely to own a home as young adults were in 1975. One in five of us are living in poverty. And based on current trends, many of us won't be able to retire until we're at least 75 years of age. But it's not all about the numbers. What is different about millennials as individuals compared to previous generations is relatively minor. What is different about the world around us is profound, however. Salaries have stagnated and entire sectors have dissipated. At the same time, the cost of every prerequisite of a safe, happy, and secure existence, education, housing, living costs, and healthcare, has inflated into the stratosphere. From job security to the social safety net, all the structures that insulate us from ruin are eroding around us. And the opportunities that feed into a comfortable, or what previous generations would refer to as a, quote, middle-class existence, you know, the things that boomers lucked into, are being lifted out of our reach or removed as realistic options altogether. Combine all the data, and it's no surprise that millennials are the first generation in modern history to end up poorer than our parents. And clinicians wonder why mental health problems are significantly rising at levels never seen before in history. This is why the touchstone experience of millennials, the thing that truly defines us, is not helicopter parenting or unpaid internships or working three jobs and still not affording rent or Pokemon Go. It's uncertainty. Some days I breathe and it feels like something is about to burst out of my chest, says Claire Horbach, a listener from Hutchison in Minnesota. I'm 29 and I still am in the same place that I was when I earned minimum wage. 4 days a week, Claire works at a dental office. Fridays she works as a nanny, and some weekends she works shifts at a local bar. And still she couldn't keep up with her rent, car lease, and student loans. So earlier this year, in 2024, she had to borrow money from her friends and family so that she could file for bankruptcy. Meredith, another listener of our show from Manchester in the UK, said, quote, I left university 11 years ago, and whilst I've found it easy to get a job, my wages have hardly increased since I started, and the cost of living has skyrocketed. Gas, electricity, water, and rent have all increased at huge levels. I thought originally it was down to Brexit, and that might be part of it, but it seems to be going on in every country. Don't even get me started on the cost of food. Meredith is a private tenant and pays rent monthly. I asked her if she intended to take out a mortgage and purchase her own home at any point. Quote, I don't think I have any chance of that. I have no savings for a deposit. All my pay is spent every month with nothing left. Not that I could afford the house prices even remotely close to where I work, unquote. Claire works in recruitment. She didn't seem to see the funny side when I suggested cutting back on avocados and iced coffees. These two voices are nothing out of the ordinary, though. I hear the same bleak anxiety from millennials in the United States, the United Kingdom, Italy, Germany, and Australia, and across the entire income scale too. Even those millennials with wealth, or at least financial comfort, still experience the struggles of their generational brothers and sisters. I spoke with bank tellers in Detroit, a nurse from Seattle, a teacher from Sheffield in the UK, a chef from Sorrento in Italy, an insurance underwriter from Edinburgh in Scotland, a photographer from Toronto in Canada, a customer service manager from Adelaide in Australia, and a driving instructor from Magdeburg in Germany. It's tempting to look at the recession or the financial crisis of 2008 as the cause of all this too, the great fuckinin, as my uncle once called it, from which we are still waiting to recover. But what we are living through now, what is considered to be an unfortunate reality, and what the recession merely accelerated, is a historic convergence of economic modalities, and many of them are decades in the making. Decision by decision, the economy has turned into a machine that just screws young people. Now, that sounds like a negative aspersion, but sometimes reality is a harsh pill to swallow. Unless something changes, our calamity will merely snowball. Have you ever worked in an office job, or a job for a multinational or large conglomerate? Man, the group interviews. 8 to 10 people in suits, a circle of chairs, a false, upbeat and chirpy HR rep with a clipboard. Each applicant telling her, one by one, in front of all the others, why they are the right candidate for this minimum wage job role as a call center operative, or bank worker, or data processor, or office admin. In 2010, David, from North London, went through this process. He had just graduated from university with a degree in economics. He had a cool £35,000 in student debt. At some of the interviews he endured, he was by far the least qualified person in the room. Other applicants described their corporate jobs and listed off their bachelor and master's degrees. Some candidates, he said, were in their 50s. Quote, the HR rep told us that she does these kind of interviews 3 times a week, David says. I just felt I was never going to get a job, unquote. David spent around 6 months of applying and interviewing and never hearing back. David actually returned to his part-time job that he worked throughout university at a local independent bar. He did that for a while, then he had a stint selling suits at a high street chain store named Next. He worked at cleaning carpets, waiting tables, and appeared as a cook at KFC, until he learned that garbage collectors in his area earned around £35,000 a year, including benefits. He's been working that job for a year now. It's the most money he's ever made. He still lives at home with his parents, although he can at least save a few £100 every month to hopefully one day try and buy a place of his own. Although David is more than aware that that reality is several years away at least. In theory, David could apply for banking jobs again, which is the career path that he wanted to eventually end up in. But he has had his degree for over a decade now, and he has no relevant experience in the corresponding financial industry. It's like a race, he says. You have a small window to secure the bag after uni before you start getting swallowed up by the road of working entry-level jobs, and sooner or later you end up in an industry miles away from where you want to be. David looks at me and pauses, reflecting. You think I want to be collecting garbage? But it's a fair wage at the moment, and it certainly beats flipping burgers. For a lot less, he says. I asked David if he had thought about going back to university and working towards his master's degree. He said he has considered it, but that would mean walking away from his salary and benefits and taking on another few £1,000 in debt, following which he feels he would likely be him still having to work entry-level positions while he gains experience, and at the age of 32, it's a thought that really doesn't appeal to him. Man, I'm sure that my parents don't want me living here forever too. I'm 32, I should have a place of my own by now. It's embarrassing and I feel guilty, David shares. At his current job, he aims to move out within the next year, though he accepts that he will have to rent, which will slow down or pause any savings contributions that go towards buying his own property. David is clear that he doesn't want anyone's sympathy. There are millions of Davids in the current economy, and David is aware of the stark reality of things. A lot of people were just 18 at the wrong time, says Will Sturgis, a personal tutor at the London School of Economics. I reached out to the university to gain some clarification from the experts. Employers didn't just say, oops, we missed the generation. In 2008, they weren't hiring graduates. Things were simpler then. And employers, while hiring graduates now, don't want people trained 10 years ago. They want the class of 2024, people with up-to-date knowledge on the market. The saying, dog eat dog, is a saying for a reason, Sturgis says. Sturgis is blunt, like he is sick of talking about this subject. In 2007, more than 50% of college students had a job offer lined up for them when they graduated. For the class of 2009, that number dropped to fewer than 20%. Currently in 2024, that number is less than 5%. According to a 2010 study by Lisa Kahn at the Journal for Labor Economics, a University of Chicago think tank, every 1% increase in the unemployment rate for the year you graduate university means a 6-8% drop in the average starting salary, a disadvantage that can linger for decades. The same study found that employees who graduated university during the 1981 United States recession were still making less than their counterparts who graduated 10 years later. I asked Sturgis to interpret this data for me from the Chicago study. He added, every recession creates these cohorts that never recover. Millennials have lived through several recessions by this stage in their life. By now, those unlucky millennials who graduated at the wrong time have cascaded downward through the economy. Some estimates show that 48% of working people in the UK, US and Canada with degrees are employed in jobs for which they are vastly overqualified. A university degree, a diploma from an established and respected higher education institution, has practically become a prerequisite for even the lowest paying positions. Just another piece of paper to show prospective employers, like all the others said employers ignore. From your high school certificates to your middle school certificates of attendance and swimming achievements and so on. It's certainly made for well-spoken and intellectually thinking sandwich artists at Subway. But the real victims of this credential inflation are the two-thirds of millennials who didn't even go to college or university. Since 2010, the economy has added 11.6 million jobs in the United States and around 4.5 million in the UK, 2.1 million in Canada and 2.9 million in Australia. I tried to find similar data for other countries like Japan, Germany, Norway, Spain, Italy and Ireland, but their governments posted data which was somewhat more convoluted and more difficult to accurately identify. In each of these countries, with the data for jobs created, an average of 95% of those jobs have gone to people with at least some college or university education. In 2016, young workers with a high school education level had approximately triple the unemployment rate, that 3.5 times the poverty rate of university graduates. Once you start tracing these trends backward, the recession starts to look less like a temporary setback and more like a culmination. Over the last 40 years, as politicians and parents and those high school guidance counselors have been telling us to study hard and build our qualification portfolios, the entire economy has transformed beneath us. For decades, most jobs growth has been in low-wage, low-skilled, temporary and short-term jobs. This is prevalent in many Western countries such as the US, UK, Canada, Australia and most of Europe. The Western countries and cultures simply produce fewer and fewer of the kinds of jobs that our parents had, but also because society and the way that we live have also moved on. This also explains why the rates of underemployment among high school and university graduates were rising steadily long before the 2008 financial crash. There are waves in the economy, but the tide has been going out for a long time. The decline of the job has its primary origins in the 1970s, with a million small changes that the boomers barely noticed that they were making at the time. The Western governments cracked down on inflation. Companies started paying executives in stock options. Pension funds were invested in riskier assets, mainly more risk and for bigger returns. Sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. The cumulative result was money pouring into the stock market like a torrential river. Between 1960 and 2013, the average time that investors held stocks before flipping them went from 8 years to around 4 months. Over roughly the same period, the financial sector became a filthy smorgasbord encompassing around a quarter of all corporate profits and completely warping companies' incentives. The pressure to deliver immediate returns became relentless. When stocks were long-term investments, shareholders let CEOs spend money on things like employee benefits because they contributed to the company's long-term health and survival. Once investors lost the ability to look beyond the next earnings report, however, any move that didn't boost short-term profits was tantamount to treason. The new paradigm took over the private equity firms, and commercial banks took corporations off the market, laid off or outsourced staff, then sold the business back to investors. In the 1980s alone, a quarter of the companies in the Fortune 500 were restructured. Almost one-third of the top 200 UK businesses at the time. Companies were no longer single entities with responsibilities to their employers, retirees or communities. They were effectively pseudo-Lego castles, clusters of distinct models that could be separated, optimized, sold and put back together. Businesses applied the same chop-shop logic to their own operations. Executives came to see themselves as first and foremost in the shareholder pleasing game. Higher staff salaries became luxuries to be slashed. Unions, the great negotiators of wages and benefits and the guarantors of severance pay, became enemy combatants. This is why in the 1990s the European Union took steps to protect employees' rights and benefits. They saw the writing on the wall. Although, let it be said that corporations quickly learned to counteract these measures, often outsourcing jobs to third world areas. And eventually, employees themselves became liabilities. Quote, corporations decided that the fastest way to a higher stock price was hiring part-time workers, lowering wages, and turning their existing employees into contractors, unquote. This was added by Will Sturgis. He also shared this nugget of information. Quote, the number of hours of minimum wage work that was needed to pay for 4 years of an average public college degree was, in boomer years, 1946 to 1964, 306 hours. In millennial years, 1981 to 1996, 4,459 hours. I wanted to check Will's quote. So I did, with the United States National Center for Education Statistics, and it was completely accurate. What's even sadder is that, of course, these hours are far, far higher for the latest generation, Generation Z. Additionally, I use the United States data as a measuring parameter here, primarily because in the United Kingdom, prior to 1998, there were no tuition fees for university. So anywhere you slice that apple there, there has been a significant jump in cost for UK millennial university education. 30 years ago, you could walk into any hotel in America and everyone in the building, from the cleaners to the security guards to the bartenders, was a direct hire, each enjoying the same benefits as everyone else. Today, indirect hires sweep the board almost entirely, 88% in fact. Employees brought in through third-party contracting companies, or what we call in the UK recruitment agencies. By 2015, these employment structures span from barbers to midwives to nuclear waste inspectors to symphony cellists. The employment sector is built differently in the UK, Germany, and Norway. For example, compared to the United States, those European countries enjoy significantly more employee rights and benefits. That said, it has still given rise to the so-called zero-hour contracts, which have become commonplace for minimum wage roles in Europe and the UK. For those unaware, or my American friends, a zero-hour contract is an employment contract where the employer does not guarantee any working hours each week to the staff member. Typically, it means that staff are asked to come in at varying days and times when the employer needs them and not when is best for the staff member. These contracts also offer significantly less benefits and rights as an hours-based contract would. As I said, zero-hours contracts are typically given in retail roles, bar work, waitering, and various other little-to-no-skill roles, and are extremely unpopular. Employers comically say that they are great options for people as it gives staff flexibility and means that they don't have to give as much commitment to a role. Perfect, they say, for students and young people. Which, of course, is complete and utter bullshit. Since the financial downturn in the United States and Canada, the industry that has added the most jobs to the economy is not tech or retail or nursing, as you might expect. The booming industry is what's referred to in the States as temporary help services. These roles are all the small, no-brand contractors who recruit workers and rent them out to bigger companies. The effect of this domestic outsourcing, and let's be entirely honest here, its actual purpose is that workers get a lot less out of their jobs than they used to. So effectively, a similar setup to the European counterpart we just mentioned. Fun United States fact, employees lose up to 40% of their salary when they are reclassified as contractors. Here's an example. In 2013, the city of Memphis in Tennessee cut wages from $15 an hour to $10 an hour after it fired all of its school bus drivers and forced them to reapply for their jobs through a third-party staffing agency. Did you know that some Walmart warehouse workers who carry boxes from trucks to shelves have to show up every morning, but they only get paid if there's enough work for them to do that day? When there isn't, they just get sent home again. Quote, by shifting tasks to contractors, companies pay a price for a service rather than wages for work. That means they don't have to think about training, career advancement, or benefit provision. This is what's really driving wage inequality, says William Sturgis. This transformation is affecting all the Western economies, but millennials are on its front line. Where previous generations were able to amass years of solid experience and income in the economies of the past, many of us will spend our entire working lives intermittently employed in the new one. We will get less formal training and fewer opportunities and benefits. Trade unions used to support 1 in 3 employees and are now down to around 1 in 10. This is by design, not by the unions, but by the governments. Do you remember Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher? Now often derided by their countrymen, they are, however, looked at by governments, politicians, and economists around the world as champions of the free market and strong, admirable leaders. As Uber and its gig economy perfect their algorithms and AI becomes more prevalent, we will be increasingly at the mercy of companies that only want to pay us for the time we're generating revenue and not a second more. Pay-as-you-go staff. But the blame doesn't only fall on large companies. No. Nearly a third of American workers now need some kind of state license to do their jobs, compared to less than 5% in 1950. It's increased regulation and tight market control. Having to provide official permission to cut hair or pour drinks, these jobs can require up to $20,000 in schooling and 2,100 hours of instruction experience and unpaid practice. The same restriction, albeit in a slightly different approach, applies in Europe and Australia too. In sum, nearly every path to a stable income now demands tens of thousands of dollars before you get your first payslip or have any idea whether you have chosen the right career path. Do you remember when you were 16? Are you working in a job or field now that you said at 16 that you were going to be? That's what the regulations and restrictions realistically require, however. Did you know that in the UK, 84% of people work in the job or industry that they started in when they left formal education or training? That number is 81% in the United States, 87% in Canada, and 79% in Australia. That's because once employees have a steady income, they build lives around that. Commitments like family, mortgages and rent and other bills. Very few individuals can afford to start again further into life and undergo complete retraining or new education. I was literally paying to work, says Carrie, a 29-year-old dietitian from Flower Mound, a suburb of Dallas in Texas. As part of her master's degree, Carrie was required to do a year-long internship at a hospital. It was supposed to be training. But she says that she actually worked the same hours and did the same tasks as paid employees at the hospital. She added, quote, "I took out an extra $20,000 in student loans to pay tuition for the year that I was working for free." I have heard the boomer generation call this paying her dues, but these internships and their subsequent requirements didn't exist before the 1990s. The equivalent then was experience on the job. In other words, getting paid for the training and experience. Government economics justify these practices by saying things like, "Non-paid internships weed out those who are not committed. They identify those who really want the job and are willing to work hard for it." They fail to mention, of course, that these internships also cause those worse off financially to have to drop out and work lower paid jobs to make ends meet. You shouldn't have to fight to do a job. The employee is already gaining from you by having you do the job in exchange for a wage in the first place. It's almost like employers aren't happy having a fair deal with staff, e.g. work for pay. They need something more to tip the sides in their favour. All of these trends, the cost of education, the rise of contracting, the barriers to skilled occupations, they all add up to an economy that has deliberately shifted the risk of economic recession and industry disruption away from companies and onto individuals. Again, this was by design, and while you watched it happen. For our parents, a job was a guarantee of a secure adulthood. For us, it's a gamble, a risk. If we suffer a setback along the way, there's very little to keep us from sliding into disaster. Becoming poor is not an event, it's a process. Like a plane crash, poverty is rarely caused by one specific thing going wrong. Usually it's a series of misfortunes, a job loss, then maybe a car accident, followed by an eviction, all interacting and compounding the situation. Will Sturgis, our London School of Economics tutor from earlier, spoke about his thoughts on poverty. Quote, "We often think of poverty as a pool, a fixed portion of the population that remains destitute for years. In fact," Sturgis adds, "poverty is more like a huge lake, with streams flowing steadily in and out all of the time. The number of people in danger of becoming poor is far larger than the number of people who are actually poor," he says. "Those triggers that activate poverty are universal. They are the same no matter what country you are in." We're all living in a state of permanent volatility. Between 1970 and 2002, the probability that a working-age person would unexpectedly lose at least half of their family income more than doubled. And the danger is particularly severe amongst younger people. In the 1970s, when boomers were our age, young employees had a 24% chance of falling below the poverty line. By the 1990s, that risk had risen to 37%. These stats apply to the UK, Europe, Australia, and Canada. The United States, however, is around 1 to 3% higher at risk. The numbers only seem to be getting worse too. From 1979 to 2014, the poverty rate amongst young people with only a high school diploma more than tripled to 22%. "Millennials feel like they can lose everything at any moment," Sturgis says, "and increasingly, more and more, they actually can." Here is what the downward slide actually looks like. Elliot is 19 years old and lives in a town called Tamworth. It's about 14 miles northeast of Birmingham, England. Elliot plays the piano and until recently was saving up to study music at the University of Manchester. Last year, in the summer of 2023, he was working at a health supplements company. The company produced items like vitamins, supplements and health foods. It wasn't the most glamorous job, Elliot admits. It was mainly lugging boxes around, packaging products, and shipping orders. Doing this job, Elliot earned the National Living Wage, which was around £7.49 per hour at that time and for his age category. He hoped at the time that he could step up to a better position if he proved himself and worked hard. Others at the company had, so he was determined to do so too. Then, Elliot's sister Catherine got into a pretty severe car accident. She was hit head-on by a drunk driver going way too fast down an unlit country road. "She couldn't walk. She had brain damage," Elliot says. Elliot and his sister were raised by a single mother who had sadly passed away when Elliot was 17. This meant Elliot had to call his boss and tell him that he would have to miss work for a day or two while he gets his sister home from the hospital and takes care of things. It wasn't long before Elliot found his zero-hour contract had been ended. He had been fired. They didn't do it right away. It was after around 3 weeks of sporadic attendance due to caring for his sister. They had no other family to support. Although every time that Elliot was unable to come into work, he followed the company's sickness reporting procedure and ensured that he kept them in the loop as to what was happening with his sister's recovery. A former colleague of Elliot said that he had heard the manager state that Elliot would never get a job there again. So now Elliot doesn't work. He spends his time as a full-time carer for his sister, who suffered life-changing injuries in the crash. They both live in a small ground-floor flat paid for by the state. The carer's allowance he gets from the government doesn't cover everything him and his sister need. Whilst rent is covered, food is so expensive right now that he is struggling and goes some days without eating. But he ensures that Catherine is looked after first. He relies on a local food bank for donations most weeks. Other bills like gas, electricity and water leave him with almost no further funds. Elliot still wants to go to university, but since he can barely keep his head above water and knowing that his sister will always need caring for, he has accepted that this is now just a pipe dream. His life is completely on hold unless he can get help from somewhere. In an economy where wages are precarious, a and the safety net has been cut to shreds, one piece of bad luck can easily become a years-long struggle to get back to normal. Over the last four decades, there has been a profound shift in the relationship between the government and its citizens. In The Age of Responsibility, its author, Yasha Monk, a political theorist, writes that before the 1980s, the idea of responsibility was understood as something each person owed to the people around them, a national project to keep the most vulnerable from falling below basic sustenance. Civil duty, national pride, social responsibility, whatever you want to call it. Even Richard Nixon, not exactly known for lifting up the downtrodden, proposed a national welfare benefit and a version of a guaranteed income in the United States. A country with even less social protections for the people than places like Europe, Australia, or Canada. But under Ronald Reagan and then Bill Clinton, the meaning of responsibility seemingly changed. The same happened under Margaret Thatcher and John Major in the UK. The same happened in Germany under Helmut Kohl, and under Bob Hawke and Paul Keating in Australia. Things became individualized, a duty to earn the benefits your country offered you. The period of self had begun. Since 1996, the percentage of poor families receiving cash assistance from the government has fallen from 68% to 23% in the United States. From 11% to 3.4% in the UK. Eligibility criteria for said benefits have been surgically tightened year on year, often with requirements that are counterproductive to actually escaping poverty. Take temporary assistance for needy families, which ostensibly supports poor families with children in the United States. Its predecessor had the goal of helping parents of kids under 7, usually through simple cash payments. This evolved, however, into these days where those benefits are explicitly geared towards getting mothers away from their children and into the workforce as soon as possible. A few states in the United States require women to enroll in training or start applying for jobs the day after they gave birth, with evidence to be provided to the state at weekly intervals. In the UK, the Unemployment Benefits Programme require similar proof of job applications in order to receive state benefit payments, with the added requirement of mandatory training for people unemployed for longer than a 12-month period. Housing assistance for many people, the difference between losing a job and losing everything, has also been slashed to a point where it is barely recognizable from the program that it was 30 years ago. United States friends tell me each state and city have a maximum allocation of rental vouchers. These vouchers are then allocated to people by importance or requirement. I chose a random city and inquired about the number of annual rental vouchers that they are able to allocate. I chose Baltimore in Maryland and spoke with the Baltimore City Housing Authority. They told me that Baltimore has 1,500 rental vouchers to allocate annually. Currently, there are around 75,000 applicants for that city alone. In the United Kingdom, housing benefit is structured differently, and each person is entitled to claim, although there is a cap on how much individuals can receive. This is often not enough to cover the full rent in an urban area, and regularly requires claimants to move to other areas where the benefits cap will cover the full rent of a property. Critics have stated that the government's aim is to herd the poor into certain areas to manage them like cattle. The government, however, states that this allegation is preposterous. Food stamps, the closest thing to universal benefits that the United States operate, provide an average of $1.40 per meal. That's around £1.10 for UK listeners, or €1.29 for European listeners, $1.91 Canadian, or $2.11 Australian. Unemployment benefits in the UK are paid at £90.50 per week, €140.75 in Germany, and $381.35 weekly in Australia. I tried to calculate unemployment benefits per week for Canada, Russia, and Japan, but they operate insurance-based contributions from the previous salaries of the claimant, so there is no fixed figure for these nations. And then there's healthcare. Okay, so I'm not going to deep dive into this section, mainly because Austria, Belarus, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Macedonia, Malta, Moldova, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Russia, Serbia, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Ukraine, Canada, Australia, South Korea, and the United Kingdom all have universal healthcare for all of its citizens. Due to this not being the case in the United States, there really isn't a direct comparison, so I'm only going to include a few facts and pieces of information. In the United States in 1980, 4 out of 5 employees got health insurance through their jobs. Now just 2 in 5 people do. Millennials are able to stay on their parents' plans until they turn 26. But the group right afterward, 26 to 34 year olds, has the highest uninsured rate in the country, and millennials, alarmingly, have more collective medical debt than that of the boomers and Generation X combined. In fact, an injury or illness in the United States is the most common trigger for somebody descending into irreversible poverty. All of us are just one life event away from losing everything, says Celine Lansing, a lawyer from Seattle who specializes in bankruptcy. Celine just happens to be a millennial too. For most of her clients under 35, she says, the slide towards bankruptcy starts with a car accident or a simple medical bill. Quote, you can't afford your deductible, so you go to MoneyTree and take out a loan for a few $100. Then you miss your payments and the collectors start calling you at work, telling your boss that you can't pay. Then he gets sick of it and he fires you and it all gets worse, she says. For a lot of her millennial clients, Lansing says, the difference between escaping debt and going bankrupt comes down to the only safety net they have, their parents. But this failsafe, like all the others, isn't equally available to everyone. The wealth gap between white and non-white families is massive, for example. Since, well, always, almost every avenue of wealth creation, be that higher education, home ownership, access to credit, has historically been denied to minorities through discrimination, both obvious and invisible. And the disparity has only grown wider since the 2008 financial crisis. From 2007 to 2010, black families' retirement accounts shrank by 35% in the United States, whereas white families, who were more likely to have other sources of money, saw their accounts grow by 9%. The result is that millennials of color are even more exposed to disaster than their peers. Many white millennials have an iceberg of accumulated wealth from their parents and grandparents that they can draw on for help with tuition, rent, or a place to stay during an unpaid internship. White Americans are 5 times more likely to receive an inheritance than black Americans, which can be enough to make a down payment on a house or pay off student loans. By contrast, 67% of black families and 71% of Latino families don't have enough money saved to cover 3 months of living expenses. And so, instead of receiving help from their families, millennials of color are more likely to be called on to provide it. Any extra income from a new job or a raise tends to get swallowed by bills or debts that many white millennials had help with. 4 years after graduation, black college graduates have, on average, nearly twice as much student debt as their white counterparts, and are 3 times more likely to be behind on payments. So do you want to get even more depressed? Sit down and think about what's going to happen to us when we get old. The scenario of what's going to happen to Social Security by the time we make it to 65. In 1950, there were 17 American workers to support each retiree. When millennials retire, there will be just 2 in the United States. In the UK, things fare slightly better as there will be 4 UK workers to every retiree. Figures are similar for most Western countries. There's one way that many have traditionally managed to build wealth for themselves, to achieve some kind of dignity and comfort in old age. I'm talking, of course, about home ownership. At least we've got a shot at that, right? Sadly, no. Sorry, everyone. Well, everyone who's still listening and hasn't wandered off into the woods to cry hysterically at the thought of their future, that is. Whenever Anthony moves into a new flat, he lies down in the starfish shape on his living room floor. It has now become a ritual, a reminder of the years he spent without a floor underneath him or a roof above. Anthony was homeless for 4 years in London in the UK, sleeping on benches, biking to interviews, arriving an hour early so he wouldn't be sweaty for the handshake or to dry off if it was raining. When Anthony finally did get a job, his colleagues found out that he washed himself in public bathrooms and slept on a park bench and made him so miserable through ridicule that he quit. "They said I smelled homeless," he says. Anthony moved to Manchester in England 6 years ago when he was 23 because he'd heard the opportunity of finding work there fared better than it did in London, at least for someone in his living situation. He got a basic role at a supermarket, or grocery store to my friends outside the UK. He slept in a shelter while he saved his money. Since then, his income has gradually increased, but he's been pushed further and further away from the city centre. First stop was temporary housing in Oldham, 30 miles away from the city. Then a rented house in Macclesfield, 50 minutes south, sharing a bedroom with his girlfriend and eventually a son. Anthony and his girlfriend eventually broke up, meaning he is now in Buxton, even further south, at more than an hour away from where he works in the city, in a one-bedroom flat right next to a busy road. And it's still a huge strain. Anthony earns £15 an hour as a security guard at a construction site, his highest wage ever. But he's a contractor, so he's employed via an agency, so he doesn't get sick leave or any other employment benefits. His rent is £1,400 a month. It's way more than he can realistically afford, but he could only find one building that would let him move in without paying the full annual rent in advance. Since rent is due on the first of each month and he gets paid on the seventh, his landlord adds a £50 late fee to each month's bill. After that, and his car payments, it's a 90-minute train ride from the suburb where he lives to the city centre where he works. He has £500 left over every month for food, toiletries, clothing and bills. That's without contributing anything to his child. Quote, "If I have anything left at the end of the month, after I have eaten and paid bills, it all goes to my son," he adds. "Although it's nowhere near the amount I would like to be giving him." Despite the acres of news pages dedicated to the narrative that millennials refuse to grow up, that there are twice as many young people like Anthony living on their own and earning less than £30,000 per year, as there are millennials living with their parents, the crisis of our generation cannot be separated from the crisis of affordable housing. More people are renting homes than any other time since the late 1960s. But in the 40 years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, rents have increased at more than twice the rate of the average income. Between 2001 and 2014, the number of, quote, severely burdened renters, unquote, e.g. those households spending over half their incomes on rent, grew by more than 50%. Rather unsurprisingly, as housing prices have exploded, the number of 30 to 34-year-olds who own homes has plummeted. Falling home ownership rates on their own aren't necessarily a catastrophe, but most Western cultures have contrived an entire game of life sequence that hinges on being able to buy a home. Certainly this is the case in the United States, Canada, the UK and Australia. You rent for a while when you are younger to save up for a deposit or down payment. Then you buy a starter home with your partner. Then you move into a larger place and raise a family. Once you pay off the mortgage, your house is either an asset to sell or a cheap place to live in retirement. The end. This worked well when rents were low enough to save and homes were cheap enough to buy. In one of the most infuriating conversations I had right in this episode, my father breezingly informed me that he bought his first house at 22 years old. It was 1973, he had just moved to Cornwall in the UK, and his job as a high school English teacher paid him, adjusted for inflation, around £60,000 a year. The house cost slightly less than £10,000, which was a large five-bedroom property with surrounding garden and a garage. A very nice middle-class property at the time. The property is valued at just over £500,000 today. I, on the other hand, am more than 12 years older, now than my dad was when he bought his first house. I earn less than what he did, and the median home price in Cardiff, Wales, where I live, is around £300,000. My father's first house cost him 21 months of his salary. My first house will cost me more than 8 years of mine. Which prompts the question, how did housing become so fucking expensive? So, you live in a city. Most well-paid jobs are located in the same area. Even the retail and service roles. Each city has a commercial area. Most people want to live fewer than 30 minutes from work. So for much of the 20th century, big cities built housing close to the jobs. When the inner ring of suburbs filled up, cities built freeways to transport employees to the next. But then those suburbs filled up too. Traffic got worse on the freeways, and 30-minute commutes became 45-minute commutes. Demand for houses close to the commercial areas exploded. That, in turn, also triggered gentrification, where the non-commercial areas, the industrial areas, but also or close to the commercial areas, were then turned into housing to meet demand, at a premium cost to cover the conversion, of course. There's a simple fix for this problem. Build more housing close to jobs. And for a long time, that's what cities did. They built upward, divided homes into apartments and flats, and added townhouses and executive gated estates. But in the 1970s, they stopped building. Cities kept adding jobs and people, but they didn't add any more housing. And that's when prices started to climb and climb and climb, forcing the market to grow at a huge rate by withholding the product. Supply and demand, but if supply is limited, then demand is higher, triggering cost hikes. In the United Kingdom, after the Second World War, councils all across the United Kingdom built cheap social housing to create homes for the many people leaving the cities for the suburbs. For minimal cost, all families could have a large home with a garden, all modernly built, with a short commute to their nearest city centre. The inhabitants paid a very reasonable monthly rent to their local council, but could effectively hold a tenancy contract for that home for their entire life. Councils made a fortune from the rents. Many families paid for the cost of the home several times over while renting them. Then, along came Margaret Thatcher. Thatcher felt families should own their own homes and dream bigger. Thatcher introduced the right to buy scheme, which meant millions of council house inhabitants purchased their council houses. She did this without building any new homes. The only problem was the council houses had little resale value. They were built in the 1950s, modern at the time, but run down and outdated by the 1980s. Families purchasing properties also didn't want to live in an area surrounded by council rental properties. With the housing market at the time bursting with cheap council house sales, creating the illusion of a booming housing market. The reality was people were buying the house that they had been living in for decades, but no new housing was actually being built and the population was growing. This caused further boom due to demand. At the same time, the United States had other issues, namely zoning. At first, zoning was pretty modest. The point was to stop someone from buying your neighbor's house and turning it into an industrial unit. But eventually, people realized they could use zoning for other purposes. In the late 1960s, it finally became illegal to deny housing to minorities. So cities instituted weirdly specific rules that drove up the price of new houses and excluded poor people, who were disproportionately minorities. Zoning regulations stated that houses had to have large backyards. They couldn't be split into separate apartments, so basically, cities mandated McMansions. The US is still living with that legacy. Across huge swathes of American cities, it's pretty much illegal to build affordable housing. And this problem is actually getting worse. That's because all the urgency to build comes from people who need somewhere to live. But all the political power is held by people who already own their own homes. For homeowners, there's no such thing as a housing crisis. Why? Well, because when property values go up, so does their net worth. They have every reason to block new construction. They do this by weaponizing environmental regulations and historical preservation rules. They force buildings to be shorter so they don't cast shadows. They demand 2 parking spaces for every single unit. They complain that a new apartment building will destroy, quote, the neighborhood character when the structure it's replacing is actually a parking garage. This is actually a true example. All this extra hassle means construction takes longer and costs more. More red tape and bureaucracy. This means that the only way most developers can make a profit is to build luxury condominiums. So that's why cities are so unaffordable. The entire system is structured to produce expensive housing when we desperately need the opposite. For most of the 20th century, the way many workers improved their financial fortunes was to move closer to opportunities. Rents were higher in the boom towns, but so were wages. But the soaring rents in big cities are now cancelling out the higher wages. There has never been a more true or accurate definition of Australia than this one over the last 10 years. Back in 1970, according to a Harvard study, an unskilled worker who moved from a low-income state to a high-income state kept 79% of his increased wages after he paid for housing. A worker who made the same move in 2010 kept just 36%. For the first time in history, it no longer makes sense for an unskilled worker in a suburban or rural area to head for a big city in the hope of building a better life. This leaves young people, especially those without a university degree, with an impossible choice. They can move to a city where there are good jobs but insane rents, or they can move somewhere with low rents but few jobs that pay above the minimum wage. This isn't where things are headed. This is the stark reality of now and has been for the last 5 to 10 years. Rather than offering citizens a way to build wealth, cities are becoming concentrations of people who already have it. In the 10 largest Western metropolitan areas, New York, London, Sydney, Los Angeles, Berlin, Chicago, Madrid, Rome, Toronto, and Paris, residents earning more than $150,000 per year now outnumber those earning less than $30,000 per year. Cities are now for the super wealthy. And so the real reason millennials can't seem to achieve the adulthood our parents envisioned for us is that we're trying to succeed within a system that no longer makes any sense. The accepted life structure that millennials have been taught and aspire to just isn't achievable anymore, and no one has thought about updating that expectation. Home ownership and migration have been pitched to us as gateways to prosperity because back when the boomers grew up, they were. But now the rules have changed and we're left playing a game that's impossible to win. We start by earning less money later in life. We have more debt and higher rent, which means we aren't able to save, which means we can't buy a house or prepare for retirement, which means that unless something changes, all of us are headed for a very dark place.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.